You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, listeners. Today is our 100th full-length episode of All the Wiser. And next week will be our farewell episode and the end of All the Wiser. If you would like to stay in touch with me and the All the Wiser team, the best way to do that is to head on over to allthewiserpodcast.com and subscribe to our newsletter. This will be a place where we can write to you when we have an idea, a story, something that we just can't imagine not sharing with you. It'll also be the place, if and when we have any upcoming projects, where you would be the first to know. So please take a minute and subscribe at allthewiserpodcast.com. And now I bring you the 100th episode of All the Wiser.
This is the moment where the magic really begins. God, 22 years later, it still makes me cry. Because in that moment, I realized that I had a choice, that I could fight to control what was happening, exactly as I had done all through my life in every different circumstance. Or I could do the thing I had been longing for, certainly my entire adult life, which is I could let go. And I don't know if it's because I was just so tired of trying to hold the world together, my world together, or if it's because it's really easy to let go when you are absolutely sure there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I made a very conscious choice, and I surrendered to falling, and everything changed.
This is Leanna Strelkoff.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are about to have a conversation about the moment you just heard. How do you refer to it? Do you refer to it as an accident? What language and words do you use?
That's a good question. What do I call it? I usually call it my fall.
Okay. Leanna's fall from a tree resulted in a spinal cord injury that left her paralyzed from the waist down. But it was from this place of deep personal crisis that she learned to tell the truth about the nature of truth, that it is complex, that we can grieve loss, feel joy, experience pain, express gratitude, and find magic in every moment for as long as we are alive and breathing. But this conversation with Leanna is not just about her story. It is about our story. Our collective human story, made of a million little moments. And isn't it the truth, and maybe even a relief, that most of these moments we have absolutely no control over? So on this, our 100th full-length episode, which is also our last, I invite you to grab a blanket, get cozy, and join me in this present moment with Leanna, as she guides us with great beauty and tenderness through letting go of control on the journey home to ourselves. I'm Kimmy Culp, and this is All the Wiser, a show about hope and possibility on the other side of pain. And today, about radical acceptance and surrender. Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
I want you to go first.
Okay, great. There's a couple different things. We're doing some intention setting here before the interview. I don't always do this with guests. And normally, this wouldn't stay in the actual episode. But this time felt different. And I thought you might like to hear it.
I keep thinking about this idea of making space for all of it. And you talk a lot about surrender and radical acceptance, which I'm really interested in. A lot of our listeners are going through periods of pain and suffering, and that's why they turn to the show, so that, you know, they feel less alone. So that's it. And I'm hoping to show up just wholly, like you, as present as I can be in this moment with you.
It feels really good. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
For me, this feels like a really important conversation. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure why this one feels so important, but so there's something about this particular conversation. And I think it's related to who you are, like who you show up as. So there, that makes something possible here that I'm not sure is possible everywhere. So it feels like we have this, we together have this potential to illuminate something that maybe stays hidden in a lot of other arenas.
Yeah.
What I long for most is for people to come away with courage and compassion for themselves, that we're all struggling. We're not all struggling to the same degree at every moment, and we're not certainly struggling with the same thing, but we're all struggling. Being human is just hard.
Yeah.
And I want to create a space where people can breathe and find themselves again, find their ground, and remember, or maybe discover for the first time, their own strength and power and resilience and ultimately magnificence.
Yeah.
And my hope is that I too feel that it's presence that makes that possible.
Yeah, all of it possible.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm trying to remember, like, this isn't about trying to show up a certain way or be a certain person or say a certain thing. It's about being available to what's going to happen in the space between you and I, mm-hmm. and relinquishing my control over that space.
Because that is always where the magic happens.
Yeah.
Always. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
How would you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Oh my God, could we start with something easier?
I know, it's a hard question, but you can do it.
Thank you. I appreciate that vote of confidence. How would I introduce myself to your listeners? My name is Liana Strelkov. I am a spiritual counselor and companion, a mom, a daughter, a wife. I am a person with a disability, a dancer, an artist, a writer, and a human sort of fumbling around trying to make the most of this experience we call life. How's that?
That, for somebody who was thought that was a tough question, that was a brilliant and beautiful answer.
Oh, that's good.
Liana grew up in Southern California, the youngest of three girls. Her mother immigrated from Russia at 20 years old. Her dad, also Russian, was a semi-professional opera singer. So there was a lot of beautiful music, friends, and parties in and around her life. But then
the music stopped. Her dad left abruptly when she was young, and her world was turned upside down.
There was a lot of pain and hurt and fear and surprise in the process of him leaving my mom in custody and things like that. So from about age 3 to 7 for me, my world was extremely unstable. And I learned a lot of lessons during that time that I struggle with or have struggled with really all my life. You know, that the world is not a safe place, that you can be hurt even from the people who love you, who genuinely love you, that I need to look for danger kind of everywhere. So by the time I was 8 years old, I was really in kind of a survival mode. And so I thought I was really broken. I thought I was fundamentally flawed. And that's why all these really hard things were happening to me and to my family. But on the outside, I was, you know, super competent and, you know, I was a pretty kind, smart, popular, all that kind of stuff. I was very, very capable and it was easy to hide behind my capabilities, but I was actually really, really, really struggling.
Yeah. So a real disconnect.
Oh, huge, huge disconnect that I didn't begin to understand until, well, college, I think. Mm-hmm. When I think about, especially in my high school years, that's when the misery really kicked in. I think that's true for many people.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how to really connect with people. And I'm certain that no one in my life realized that because I was very well regarded. You know, I was always respected and admired, but I had nobody to eat lunch with. I didn't know how to have authentic, intimate, real relationships. I knew how to take care of people.
Yeah.
I was really good at that. And I didn't realize I was dying of loneliness.
After high school, Leanna went to UC Irvine for college and majored in drama. She started performing from a young age, dancing, singing, and acting all throughout her time in school. She considered going into law, but soon realized that being an artist was what really made her come alive. A year after she graduated, she moved to France for 18 months to study a very physical and experimental form of theater with a company in Paris, in French.
Yeah, I would have stayed longer. I wanted to stay longer, but I got my heart broken and I needed to come home.
Yeah. Did you have, I guess, if or how did you experience faith, spirituality? Was it part of your upbringing, your experience as a young person? Was it something?
It wasn't really part of my upbringing. I mean, my family was part of the Russian Orthodox Church and my father was choir director, but we were not a religious family. I never read the Bible or studied, or that sort of traditional religious route was not part of my life. But I was a really spiritual kid in the sense that I had a really deep connection with nature from a super young age. My father was this kind of mountain man. And so we used to go backpacking and I felt incredibly at home in the woods, in the wild. I didn't know to call it spirituality at the time. I didn't know that's what it was. I didn't have a name for any of that until I was well into my 20s. But it was always a huge part of my life.
Yeah, just a deeper connection to something much bigger than you.
And I always felt that. I always felt that sort of presence, that there was something bigger than me and we were in relationship.
Yeah, that makes sense. You didn't yet have the language or the understanding that you have today.
And I leaned on that a lot.
How so?
I took myself into the woods. I went hiking periods of my life, for years of my life. I went hiking every week, every weekend. I just knew that that was the place that I felt whole. That was the place I felt held. And so I made a point to have that be part of my life, even though I couldn't name it.
Yeah. So I want to talk about a day that changed. Every day, I guess, changes our lives, but a day in particular, which you've described as the fall. At the time you were 33, can you, you know, briefly set the stage where you were in your life at that time?
Yeah. I was in a really difficult time in my life. I had just been through a very major breakup. I had been in and out of relationship with someone for almost 18 years. And we had been very, very close friends, even when we weren't partners. We'd lived together three times. And we had just broken up for good. And it was his choice. So I was a wreck. But I was really unwilling to be a wreck. I just wanted to kind of zoom past the hard part and get on with, you know, okay, this didn't work out. And let's make something different of our life. So I was really pushing myself to get over it, move on. But I, in general, was very anxious. I was an anxious person to begin with ever since I was a kid. I was always looking for where things might go wrong. I was always trying to control how my life unfolded. And it's very hard to live a life when you're trying to keep your hands on all of it and make sure that nothing goes somewhere you don't expect and nothing goes somewhere bad. And it takes a tremendous amount of energy. And I was constantly sort of blocking the flow of my own life. I couldn't see it that way at the time. At the time, I just wanted to feel safe and happy and comfortable. So this effort that I was putting in was making things really hard.
So what did that look like, the exhaustive pursuit of the illusion?
The illusion of control?
Yeah.
Well, certainly internally, it looked like this constant mental activity and trying to predict how something was going to go and not taking an action until I felt I knew where it was going to land. So my career was completely stalled as a performer. I was a member of a very well-regarded theater company here in LA, but I wasn't making any money at all as an actor. And I couldn't put myself out there at all because I just had no idea where things were going to go if I did that. It felt much too risky. So my career was stalled. As I said, this relationship was falling apart. And I was, I don't know that I would say chronically depressed, but I was sort of in and out of depressions, and they could last months and months, ultimately because I was anxious and I couldn't let myself live. And that was really depressing. It was really depressing to feel separated from life like that.
That makes so much sense to me.
Yeah, it was, oy, I was a mess. I was a mess. And not in the ways that we sometimes think of people being a mess. Like, you know, I wasn't addicted to anything. I wasn't, you know, sleeping around. I wasn't gambling. You know, I wasn't doing any of the things that we sort of, we look at. I was just not really alive and really afraid and ashamed of being afraid. Like, that was the big one. There was so much shame. That's why nobody could see, because I wouldn't let anybody see what was happening on the inside. I was so ashamed of not being able to function properly and feeling inherently broken and trying to hide that from the world.
Yeah. I'm familiar with all of that. Deeply familiar. At this point, Leanna is 33. She's living in Los Angeles and performing in an ensemble theater company with around 10 other actors. And at the first meeting of this newly formed company, a man walked into the room, a man named Dean.
And I had seen him on stage before. We'd never met, but I'd seen him on stage before. And I was really annoyed when he was on stage. I was really annoyed with what he was doing as a performer. And I felt like...
Just like critiquing it?
Yeah. I felt like my sense was two things. One, that he was disrespecting the material. And I like had no patience for that. And that he, the actor, had issues with the material. And I was seeing that in his performance, which I thought was totally inappropriate. And the other thing that I, the sense that I had was that he was better than what he was giving us. And that made me mad.
Yeah.
And so I didn't like this guy. And so he walks into the meeting. He's one of the 10 actors. And I saw him walk in the door a couple minutes late, which also irritated me. And I just thought, okay, well, I'm a professional. I can work with this person, but I don't need to know anything about him. Like, I don't need to have any kind of relationship with him outside of work. And he had the exact opposite experience. He walked in the door and he saw me and said to himself, ooh, like, I want to know her. And of course, when you're working with somebody so closely, and you're in rehearsals together all the time. We actually lived at that time two blocks from each other. So we were carpooling also together. I don't know. He just, I often say he loved me into loving him, but it was very, very bumpy. We started this relationship and it had all of the hallmarks of a new relationship. You know, it had this sort of excitement and, you know, wondering what it's going to be. But for me, wondering what it's going to be is like angsting over what it's going to be.
Yeah.
And so that morning, I had actually spent the night with him and we were supposed to go for a hike that morning. And the morning was fun because we made love that morning. And it was probably, at the time, I was certain it was the best orgasm of my life. And I remember laying there having that thought, like, oh my God, like that was it. That was it. And bless his heart, he wanted to stay in bed. He wanted to spend the day in bed. But I was imagining the future of that day. I was imagining having not gone hiking and I really wanted to be out there. I was imagining that I was going to regret that and I needed to get out of that bed. And I didn't really understand why at the time, but I just was like, no, we got to go. We're going to go do this. And so we got in the car and we drove up to Charmley Park, which is in Malibu.
How long had you guys been dating?
Officially a couple of months.
A couple months. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, it's new. It's really new.
Okay.
So we get in the car, we drive up to Charmley Park. It's in Malibu. Neither of us had ever been there before, and I'd been wanting to go. And it's really hot. It's October, but it's really hot. And so we're on this trail, and I am so anxious, I don't know what to do with myself. And I definitely don't want this to be seen. I don't want him to know, because I'm anxious about him. I don't know if I want this relationship, if I don't want this relationship. I don't know how it's going to turn out. He's really different from me, and he's really different from anyone I've ever dated. And that's confusing to me, and I can't make sense of like sort of really liking him and really not liking him all at the same time. And I've been very push-pull the whole time I've known him, and I feel bad about that. It's hard on him. And so I feel like I have to have it figured out. I have to know, do I want this? I have to be sure if I don't want this, because I can't say I don't want this and then try to reel him back in. And I am in my own mind gnawing on these questions. And it feels awful. And I'm thinking about it the whole drive out there. And I think I'm going to feel better once we get to the park. Then we arrive and we get out on the land and I don't feel any better. And so I lead us into this grove of oak trees off the trail. And I think I'm going to feel better surrounded by these trees. And I don't feel any better. And then I spot this perfect tree in the corner of the grove. And I think I'm going to feel better in the arms of that tree. And I start climbing. And I'm about 25 feet up in this tree. And I don't feel any better. And I see this perch different from the one that I'm sitting in. It's about, I don't know, 5 feet lower. And I think I'm definitely going to feel better down there. If I can just nestle into that perch right there, I'm going to feel better. And so I crawl down there. And the whole time that this is going on, I'm basically keeping Dean talking. Dean, my boyfriend, I'll ask him a question that I know is going to be sort of a long answer. Like, I think I at one point I said, didn't you say that you used to play Dungeons and Dragons? I don't know anything about that game. Like, how do you play? So, of course, there's this 45-minute monologue, which is exactly what I was trying to do. So he's just talking, and I'm not really listening. I'm just paying attention to what's going on inside my own head. So I climb down to this lower perch, and I'm standing almost perfectly vertical, a big, big, wide open oak tree. I've got my feet on two thick branches, like thick as my thighs. And my left hand is resting lightly on this smaller branch. It's a little bit behind my body. And Dean starts telling me this joke. And it's taking forever. This is like huge, huge setup for this joke. And as I'm waiting patiently for a punchline, I hear this loud crack. And as soon as I heard it, I realize what's happening. That a branch is broken and I'm going to go down. And I sort of reach in front of me, you know, kind of flailing with both arms to see if there's anything I can grab, if there's a branch anywhere that I can grab. And there's just nothing there. And Dean's out of reach. And this is the moment where the magic really begins. God, 22 years later, it still makes me cry. Because in that moment, I realized that I had a choice. That I could fight to control what was happening. Exactly as I had done all through my life in every different circumstance. Or I could do the thing I had been longing for, certainly my entire adult life. Which is I could let go. And I don't know if it's because I was just so tired of trying to hold the world together, my world together, or if it's because it's really easy to let go when you are absolutely sure there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I made a very conscious choice. And I surrendered to falling. And everything changed.
You know, I've heard you talk about this perfect presence that happened. And it makes sense to me. Will you tell me, because I think so many people would go to panic, fear, all of the, and that wasn't your experience. It was so different.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I made that choice, there's a series of things that happened that I had nothing to do with.
And this is all like milliseconds.
I think if you do the physics, it's 1.2 seconds.
Wow.
As soon as I made the choice to surrender to falling, I dropped into slow motion. So for me, I felt like I was in the air, I don't know, 10 minutes, maybe. Like I was up there forever and everything slowed way down. And this incredible peace came over me. And I had this startling awareness that I'd never, like a level of awareness that I'd never had before. I was acutely aware of the peace that I was feeling. I had time to notice the shape of my body in the air. I had time to notice that I was noticing. It was like layer after layer after layer of awareness.
So it's deeply spiritual.
Oh, incredibly.
Yeah.
Experience. Incredibly. And blissful. Absolutely blissful. And people have so often asked me, you know, weren't you afraid? Weren't you afraid of dying? Weren't you afraid of getting hurt? And the thing about fear is that it's always about the future.
Yeah.
And I was, for the first and maybe only time in my life, 100% in the present. So it's not that I had those thoughts but wasn't afraid. It's that those things never occurred to me.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't in that moment injured or dead or I was floating.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I hit the ground, I was falling backward out of the tree. So I never saw the ground coming. And it was a total shock. The ground hit me. I was in the air in love, in pure love. And the earth shot up and slammed into me. And I never lost consciousness. It didn't even knock the wind out of me, which I think is so strange.
So what happens after you, the ground comes up and hits you?
Yeah. So I'm conscious and awake, but I'm having a really hard time breathing. And it's extremely painful to breathe. So I'm taking these tiny little breaths because that's all I can do. And Dean, who was also in the tree by that point, he jumps down from the tree and he comes to kneel down next to me. And I'm having this really weird sensation. First of all, it feels like I'm wearing this very thin, tight belt all of a sudden around my waist that I can't quite figure out why I feel that. And I can feel my legs, like my sense of my legs, as if I am, if you can imagine being seated in a chair and then the chair tips over backward and you're in that sort of L position.
Yeah.
That's how that was my own sense of my body. But if that were true, I would be able to see my knees laying on my back. I'd be able to see my legs and I couldn't see them. And so he dropped down next to me asking me if I was okay. And I just said, "Where are my legs?" Then he looked at me like I was insane and he sort of reached out. Like I saw his hand go out and he's like, "They're right here." But I couldn't tell what he was doing and I didn't feel anything and I couldn't see. And so I reached down where he had reached and I felt this incredibly soft, like silken texture, like out in the middle of the woods, you know, on the floor of the woods. And I said, "What is that?" And he just turned white and he said, "It's your leg."
Coming up, the impact of Leanna's fall. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break. All the Wiser is a one-for-one podcast. For every story you hear, we donate $2,000 to our guest's favorite charity. Leanna chose Canine Companions. In her words, they are a stunning organization that breeds, raises, and trains service dogs. Leanna knows the power of their work firsthand. She is a two-time recipient of a service dog, Reba, who was with her for 10 years, and Grant, her current companion. To learn more about their work, you can find them at canine.org. That's canine.org. Thank you.
So I had landed on my back and my legs had continued traveling. So they came over my head, essentially. I was folded in half by the impact, and then my legs sort of snapped back to the ground. And what had happened in that moment of impact is that I had dislocated my spine severely between T10 and T11, which is a little below the middle of the spine. And that I had shattered one of my vertebrae, T11. And that dislocation was crushing my spinal cord completely. So I was instantly and totally paralyzed from the waist down.
And he went to get help and you were there looking up at the tree, right?
Yeah.
In the sky.
Yeah, by myself.
Yeah.
It was actually, it was amazing moments. We were off the trail. So we had called 911 and the paramedics had said, or the operator had said that Dean would have to meet the paramedics at the trailhead in order to bring them where we were. And he fought hard not to leave me, but they were adamant that he had to do that. So he left and I was laying on the ground, taking these tiny little breaths. I had also busted a rib and it ripped a hole in my right lung. So my right lung was collapsed. That's why I couldn't breathe. It's also why I was having trouble talking. You know, I was barely whispering because I couldn't get enough air to make sound. And as I laid on the ground, I heard a voice in my head, my own voice in my head, my own voice, but not a voice controlled by me. Then it said to me, "Everything you need to know is happening right now." And so I started to scan, like, what is happening? What's happening right now? And the first thing that I became aware of was surrender. Then the next thing was presence. And the next thing was faith. And the voice said, "That's the way home. Remember." And I knew in that moment that the hardest thing was going to be remembering this wisdom, like that things were about to get a lot harder.
Yeah.
And that the hardest thing was going to be remembering this. And I had these experiences while I was laying there where, like, it occurred to me that maybe I should be scared. This is the kind of situation that warrants being afraid. And I could feel, like, from my gut, this wave starting to come up. Like, I could go to this place and be really afraid. And I thought, God, why would I do that? I am so held, and there's just no reason to do that. So it wasn't like pushing the fear down. It was just a choice to stay really present. And then it occurred to me that maybe I should pray, that this is the kind of situation that people pray in, whether or not they believe in something they're praying to. And then that seemed ridiculous, because to pray, I would have to pretend that I was alone, that this presence, source, spirit, God, goddess, whatever you want to call it, wasn't there. And then I would pray and ask to be held and taken care of. But it was there. We were one. So there was no need. There was no need to ask for that. I was already held. And then finally the paramedics and Dean came back.
Leanna and Dean were medevaced on a helicopter to the UCLA Trauma Center, where they began a flurry of tests. X-ray, CT scan, MRI, and then a nurse told her that she was going in for surgery.
And I was like, "Wait, surgery? What for?" And she looked at me and she said, "Well, you've broken your back." And apparently that was utterly obvious to everyone except me.
Because what did you think if you would have been asked right then?
I would have said, "I don't know."
Yeah.
Obviously, I knew I couldn't feel my legs, but I didn't know that that inevitably meant my back was broken and my cord was crushed.
Yeah.
I didn't know what other options there might be. And I was really rooted in the present. So I wasn't thinking about like that sort of future moment. What could this be? What's going to happen? What does it mean? All of that is in the future.
Yeah.
So that's the first I heard that I had broken my back. I don't remember being told about my spinal cord being crushed, although I cannot imagine that after surgery they didn't tell me that. What I remember them telling me is that they were very surprised that I had not ruptured any of my organs except for the lung. Because of the height of my fall, they were expecting that I had ruptured other things. They were concerned about internal bleeding and things like that, and there was nothing. I had fragments of bone all over the place, so that had to be cleaned up, and they had to reset my back because it was so dislocated it had come to lock in that dislocated position, which of course wasn't helping my spinal cord any. And they never told me that I'd never walk again, that sort of cliche. I never heard that. I went to rehab at a different hospital, and there the rhetoric was, you have a very serious injury. So if I talked about recovery, you know, I was super invested in the beginning in recovering everything that I had lost because it was becoming instantly clear how much I had lost.
And what you had lost, and we're also going to get to the many things, both the loss and the gain, right? Mm-hmm. But the process of grieving that loss and relearning everything. Mm. I mean, explain that, really, this new life school.
Mm. Yeah, there's sort of those are two really different things. The
practical, like the
right, right. Yeah. The practical of like learning, yeah. Like how do I function?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the emotional side, the psychological and emotional side of being with that kind of loss. So just so it's clear, I have no movement below my waist. So even my lower abdominal muscles don't work. So my balance is compromised when I'm in a sitting position. I can't do all the things that you would think of. I can't, you know, run, jump, stand, walk, dance. We should definitely talk about that. I can't do any of that stuff, but I also can't feel anything. So I can't feel hot or cold. I have burned myself several times, burned to blister, because I can't sense that I have something searing my leg. I can't control my bowel or my bladder. I have no sexual sensation. All of that was lost in an instant. And that's only the immediate. There's also the losses that come with aging with a spinal cord injury. So things like my arms now, 20 years later, are starting to give out, losing cartilage in my shoulders because your shoulders are not meant to be weight-bearing. They're not physically built for that. They're built to swing. And mine have to carry me all the time. Being able to get in and out of bed, roll over in bed, all of these things take my upper body helping. I can't put my legs in a position and have them stay there. They sort of have a mind of their own. They do all sorts of weird things. It's a little like, you know, getting dressed, like putting pants on an octopus, you know, they, it's a thing. It's a huge thing.
But the relearning of just getting out of bed, getting in bed, opening a heavy door, taking a shower, shopping, cooking. I mean, what was that like?
In the beginning, it was really difficult, but not because the actions or activities were difficult. But learning all of those things is what brings home the fact that you're in this position, that you have all of these losses. So emotionally, it was really difficult. And that made the work of it difficult. Also, yeah. I couldn't control my blood pressure. It took a long time for my body to regulate. Apparently, your muscles, they have something to do with moving the blood along. And so I was getting all this pooling blood in my legs. And so my blood pressure was super, super low. So I'd sit up and I'd pass out. So in the beginning, it was incredibly difficult. And I feel in some ways, I was in rehab for exactly eight weeks. And I feel like I learned almost everything in the last maybe 3 weeks of rehab. It was easier for me than I think it is for a lot of people because I know my body. I've been a dancer my entire life. And so it was not hard for me to learn how to transfer from my chair to the bed. But the emotional side of learning those things was incredibly hard. And the stamina, I didn't have that. And I didn't have the upper body strength. The wheelchair skills, those were really hard to learn. How to go over, say, grass or gravel with my casters popped up, like basically rolling in a wheelie. I'm still really bad at that. And the awkwardness of opening a heavy door, things like that. That was hard. It was really hard.
In those first couple of weeks, Leanna took the same approach to her recovery that she did with that big breakup. She set her sights on recovery. She committed to having the right thoughts, to feel the right feelings, and to not let in any doubt that she would have the outcome she imagined for herself. And for 2 weeks, she did that. But then she got sick and she couldn't get out of bed at the hospital. That's when she learned that the hospital had a complementary medicine program that included acupuncture. And because she had grown up with parents who were into natural medicine, requesting to see an acupuncturist was a no-brainer and a welcome break from the Western medicine roller coaster.
So this acupuncturist came and did what they do, listened to my pulses and said, you know, your effort to control everything about your experience is like clogging up all of your organs. Like you are making yourself sick. And I realized then that I was going to have to allow my authentic experience, that whatever my intentions were for recovery, I had to get real. And that meant allowing my grief. And so the first wave of that was actually 3 solid days. I refused all of my therapies. I wouldn't leave my room. And I actually had Dean with me at the time. And I just wailed. I laid in my bed and he laid in my bed next to me. And I told him ahead of time that there wasn't going to be anything that he could do. He wasn't going to be able to help or fix this. And that what I needed was for him to just be with me. And I literally just screamed into my pillow and cried for 3 days. And after that, I was able to start therapies again and keep doing the work. And then after that, I would be fine for a long time because there was so much magic happening and that would carry me. And then I'd get hit. I'd get hit by the grief kind of out of nowhere. Sometimes something would bring it on, like not being able to dance. That was among the hardest things that I had to face. Not being able to dance in the way that I was used to. I also had some of the best dances of my life in my chair, but.
Well, that was your form of expression.
It was my form of everything.
Everything.
It was exercise. It was church. It was expression. It was how I found myself again. It was how I processed my emotions. It was therapy. It was everything. It was everything. And to have the impulse to move and not be able to move was maddening. And crushing, absolutely crushing.
Was that the greatest loss, the ability to dance in the way that you used to?
Yeah. I think in many ways, the hardest loss is the loss of my sexual sensation.
Yeah.
And I think at different times in my life, different losses have hit me. You know, the hierarchy changes.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's not always the same.
You talk a lot in your work about surrender, which is, there's no point in this story that's linear, right? It's not as if you get to surrender and then
And then you're done and you've just mastered it. Oh my God, every day, every day.
So, you know, surrender happens the moment, right? In the oak tree. But, you know, what are some of the other moments where this radical acceptance of your life, your body, where you are now? I mean, so hard and liberating and free all at once.
Yeah, all at once are the key words there. I think that that's among the most powerful lessons of this experience for me. It's grown my capacity to hold a really, really wide truth. Because the fact is, the truth is a really big place. There are almost always multiple things true at once, conflicting things. You know, even as I'm speaking to you about the loss of dance, it is also true that I've had these amazing dances from the chair. Even as I grieve the loss of my sexual sensation, I have this amazing relationship with Dean. You know, we've been together now almost 22 years. We've been married, what, 17 of those? So there's all this joy. And sometimes, I swear, Kimmy, sometimes I'm feeling it all at once.
Yeah.
Where I miss so much what I used to have with Dean. And I so treasure everything that I do have right here, right now. I can't really function if I deny any part of that. So I'm always making space for everything to belong. Always, always, always.
Yeah.
And inviting all these parts of my experience, all these parts of myself. You know, that shame that I felt so intensely when I was growing up and as a young adult. I don't live with that in the same way. It's not that I don't feel shame, but that when that feeling comes up, now there's this kind of mechanism or this habit, this approach that welcomes that as part of my human experience.
And you created a one-woman show, which you took around the country. Tell me a little bit about the show and the role it played in your healing and the types of reactions or stories that came as a result.
When I was still in rehab, I met a therapist. She was part of my team, and she asked me to tell her how I had ended up in this specialty hospital for spinal cord injury. And I told her this 20-minute story. And when I was done, she said, "First, I want to tell you that nobody gives me more than 3 sentences. So I'm just amazed that you gave me this whole story." And she said, "And I know that it's much, much too soon for you to think about this, but I do want to share with you that I see you telling this story, like on television." And I thought, okay, that's absurd. Whatever, moving on. But lo and behold, I got out of the hospital 2 months later. And within 6 weeks of that, I became absolutely compelled, like I'd never experienced before, to tell these stories. That there was so much magic happening that I did not see coming, that I never would have anticipated, that was so gorgeous. And I had paid this really high price for the insight and the wisdom and the experience that I was having, the magic that I was experiencing, that if I was the only one who was going to benefit, it was too high a price. Like I had to share it. I had to. And so I crafted, I'd never, you know, I've been performing for a long time, but I'd never, ever written my own stuff. So I crafted this very informal show. You know, some of it was reading, like journal entries from when I was in the hospital, super informal. And I just invited, you know, family and friends. And I
I borrowed the stage that my theater company was on at the time and left their set there behind me and just got up and I told these stories. And we videotaped it. And when I saw the tape, two things struck me. One was I did not recognize the woman on the stage. I was like, who the hell is she? That woman is on fire. She's amazing. And the other thing that I noticed was what was happening in the audience, which is that there was some kind of transformative experience happening there that I didn't anticipate in any way. And that motivated me to create a full-length show. And I had no idea how to do that. So I angsted over it for a year and a half, but I finally connected with a director named Paul Link, and we spent a summer meeting twice a week, and I just told him stories. And bit by bit crafted this full-length show, 90 minutes. And for me, I had two goals when I wrote the show. One was I wanted to tell the truth. A lot of people misunderstood what my experience was as a paralyzed person. They either thought I could do far more than I could, or they thought I could do far less than I could. And that inability to see me correctly was rendering me invisible. And I had felt in this odd way my whole life so invisible because I wouldn't let anybody see the real me that it was unbearable.
Yeah.
To suddenly be rendered invisible. And so I wanted people to understand the truth of this experience, the whole truth. So that was one goal. And the other goal was I wanted to create something of beauty. And I think that's where the healing, well, I was going to say that's where the healing is, but actually that's not true. The healing is in the relationship between those two things, because the truth isn't always beautiful. And so there was something about the overlap and the relationship between truth and beauty that I needed. So Paul and I worked on this show and we put it in front of an audience in this tiny little theater in Santa Monica, maybe 40 seats, the Ruskin Group Theater. And I don't know, something happened. Like, people just kept coming back. We were supposed to do 3 weekends. And the show got extended 5 times. We ended up running for 6 months. People were coming back 2 and 3 and 4 times. I would show up at the theater on Fridays. We were just doing the weekends. And I'd show up on Friday afternoon and there'd be this stack of mail, people writing to me who had seen the show, sending me gifts, sending me, I mean, all sorts of stuff. It was this phenomena. You know, I was taking people on my transformative journey. And I felt such incredible care and love and responsibility for them. And being able to have these companions in my experience, to know that I was seen and seen correctly,
yeah,
seen in my wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
Seen, yes, this is tragic and it's horrible and it's hard and it's gorgeous and transcendent and beautiful. It was incredible. It was a really incredible experience. And I saw that for many people that saw the show, it was like a mirror for them. Even though, you know, I mean, I think I had, in 6 months, I think I had 5 people with paralysis come and see the show. You know, it's not like my audience was having the same experience I was having. But people were seeing themselves because everybody struggles. And everybody grieves and experiences loss. And everybody has challenges. And everybody feels shame. And everybody's scared. And everybody loves and wants to be loved. And so people could see themselves in this experience. And even beyond that, people could see the strength that lived inside themselves. They could see themselves as survivors. They could see themselves as thrivers. You know, we had nights where people would come up to me after the show and they'd put their head in my lap and cry. But it wasn't just crying in pain. It was, that's what happens when you're holding all of it.
Yeah.
It was such an honor. It was such an honor to be part of that process, to make that available and to receive it myself. It was such an honor.
Well, the idea that, you know, they show up thinking they're going to be entertained or girls' night or date or, you know, whatever it may be, and that people were, you know, I imagine changed, you know, whether it's in the moment or...
Yeah.
And that's the... When you talk about the magic and the transcendence, and you do such a wonderful job of sort of honoring and holding that, that doesn't come by denying the hard.
No, in fact, denying the hard gets in the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Authenticity is the path.
Yeah.
For sure.
And that's how you were showing up at those shows. The whole you, the whole story.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be seen. You know, the other thing when we spoke, you know, I said, what are people most curious about, or what are the questions you most get asked? And I think you said it's, why were you in the tree and can you still have sex? What were you doing in a tree? So we know what you were doing in a tree, but how can we better understand people living with paralysis so we can do a better job at doing our best to see and understand? Because you've said people are either think you can do far more or far less. So I just think it's would be wonderful for you to share with me so other people can hear.
You know, it's tricky because not everybody, for instance, who's paralyzed is having the same experience.
Yeah.
And particularly if it's a spinal cord injury, which it may not be. There are other reasons that people are paralyzed. But spinal cord injuries are incredibly different one to the next, even if somebody's injured at the same level. So you cannot, upon looking at someone, know what their experience is.
Yeah.
Even if you've heard all about mine, you can't know what theirs is. And so I think that the best place that we can position ourselves is, one, to check our assumptions, to recognize that we're having assumptions about what somebody's life is. And one of those primary assumptions, the first one that seems to hit us, is that that person is miserable.
Yeah.
That it must be awful to be paralyzed. And I assure you, there are moments when it is truly awful.
Yeah.
That's not untrue, but it's just one little piece of the whole experience. And nobody wants to be reduced to one little piece of their experience. That doesn't feel good to anyone.
Yeah.
So recognizing that we can't know what somebody's going through, we need to be aware that we are making assumptions and maybe check in a little bit about what those are. And the other thing is that we tend to project onto others what we imagine we would be feeling. There's two problems with that. One, the obvious, that we're projecting ourselves onto others and they are having a different experience. They're a different person. But two, we're probably wrong about what we would be feeling.
Yeah.
Because if you had asked me, like seconds before I was paralyzed, if I could survive or thrive or be okay as a person with paralysis, I would have been utterly sure that I could not. That if you take away my ability to dance, if you take away my ability to have sex normally and to feel all of those feelings, if you take away my ability to climb and to run and to hike in the woods, if you take away the things that matter the most to me, that bring me the most joy, I would have been certain that I could never recover, that I would never be happy, that it would devastate me forever, that my life would be unworth living. And I would have been completely wrong. You just can't know until you're there and you're in it. And so not only are we projecting something onto another person, but we're projecting something that might not even be true for us.
Yeah.
I remember being asked by a, I did a Valentine's show. My husband and I did a Valentine's show in a story salon here in LA. And we were being asked about our relationship. And it became evident really quickly that there was a presumption being made that the hardest thing in our marriage is my disability. And after about the second question, I thought, wait, we have to, for me, the hardest thing in my marriage is actually my childhood trauma.
Yeah.
It's the way that that affects me and how I have to meet that and be with that and work with that. This sense that, you know, marriage, family, love, like that's the danger zone. That's where bad things happen. My disability is difficult for sure and definitely makes a huge impact in our life and the how we do things, both what we do, but especially how we do them. But it is not, in my opinion, at least for me, the hardest part of being married. It's just the most visible hard part.
Yeah. It makes, I keep saying it makes a ton of sense, but it really makes a ton of sense that that would not, in fact, be the hardest part of any marriage, right? Mm-hmm. Learning how to build a life and stay and, you know, again and again, choose each other when we all come from such different, you know, pasts.
Or people will put Dean on a pedestal and be like, oh, it's amazing, you know, that he stayed and, you know, all these years he's still with her. And one, it annoys him because he feels reduced. Also, he feels like people are, you know, making some hero out of him. And he feels like, look, it's way more complex than that. And I'm not so great at some of this. And, you know, there's more to that story. And I sort of feel insulted. Like, there are good reasons to be here. You
yes.
know, I'm a good person to be in relationship with, actually. And we have this really full and loving and fun and joyous and super supportive relationship. But this is what we kind of do as humans by nature, is we reduce things into these little bits that feel more comprehensible. And nothing is that simple.
Yeah. Where are you in your life today, both, you know, personally and professionally?
Well, I stopped touring my show after I gave birth to my son. We went on one tour with him when he was about 7 months old, and after that, I'm like never going to do that again. So my professional career has changed directions considerably. I was a coach for a period of time, which wasn't quite the right container for me. And then after my first service dog died, I had a service dog for 10 years named Reba, who was the center of my world. And I lost her to cancer in 2021. And companioning her through the last 8 weeks of her life was one of the greatest privileges of my life. After all she had been to me, all she had done for me, to be able to hold that space for her was an extraordinary gift. And I actually went back to school after that, and I got my certification in inner spiritual counseling and companioning. So that's the work that I do now. I'm in private practice, and I work primarily with people with chronic injuries or illness, some healthcare professionals, and caregivers. And the work is perfect for me. It's the most joyous and satisfying and meaningful work that I could imagine. I love it, absolutely love it. I work with people all over the country who want to deepen their sense of connection with Source, I'll call it, whatever they want to call it, who want to attend to their inner life and to come home to themselves. That's the best way that I can put it, to remember who they really are outside of our circumstance, beneath our circumstance, are the things that are going on moment to moment, to come back to that spiritual sense of who we are and connect from there. So that's extraordinary work, and I absolutely love it. I feel so privileged, so, so privileged to do that work. Personally, it's a challenging time right now. I think I mentioned a little while ago that my arms are breaking down. So after 21 years in the chair, I'm having a lot of issues with my shoulders and elbows and wrists. And so I have to change my lifestyle. I have to move into the power chair at least part-time, and that causes all kinds of other changes that have to take place in the house and my vehicle. And I'm in a new phase of transition. I've been stable for a really long time, but now it's almost like starting over in a way. And that's very intense. It's very challenging. And it is scary. Those future thoughts, you know, hopefully I have another 20 plus years of life in front of me, and I need my arms to last. So this has been a kind of a brutal wake-up call. And it's asking for my attention in a way that honestly I don't want to give. I wish I didn't have to think about this. I wish I could just do my work and love up on my new service dog and be with my son and his adolescence and be with my husband, you know, do the things that I love and not have to think about this. But I don't have that luxury. So we meet it. We meet the moments. I meet the moments. Inside, as much as this is a really hard time, there's also chronic pain involved now, which I've never had. That's never been part of my spinal cord injury experience until 14 months ago. So being in relationship with that, it's like a new character in the play of my life who's always hanging around, you know. But that said, I feel so grateful for this life that I'm living. There are amazing things in it, but the relationship that I have with my own life, the relationship that I have with my experience is so rich and so deep. And I would not trade that. That's a gorgeous, gorgeous thing. And so, yeah, it's a really challenging time. And I'm doing, if you ask me how I am, I'm doing so well because of that depth and that richness.
What brings you joy?
So many things. Sunshine on my face, making and looking at art, playing with the dog, working. Like when I'm having a really bad day, I love that if I have clients that day, because companioning is itself for me a spiritual practice. So working brings me extraordinary joy. Music, listening to music, dancing still brings me great joy. So much. Chocolate, dark chocolate, that's definitely on the list. Conversations like this, being real with people, being allowed to witness what's real for people brings me immense joy.
Me too. What do you hope people take away from your story?
I know that we're all scared. We're all scared of bad things, you know, whatever those bad things are. They're not always the same bad things person to person, but I think that we are all scared of the things that hurt, the things that feel unmanageable, the things that we fear we can't handle. We're all scared of life not going well or not getting better if it's already going poorly. This human experience has a lot of hard things about it. And I guess I hope that people might recognize that even when it's really hard, there is magic to be found and joy to be found. And I want to be really careful about shaming anyone who's not having that experience, who feels like, look, it's just really hard and that's all there is. Because sometimes it does look like that. And it's not a failure if we're not also grateful or also joyful. But my hope is that there's something in what people hear today that maybe gives them a little bit of courage, that maybe inspires them
to make some room for all the things that are true. And know that letting everything belong is a path to a fundamentally joyful, meaningful, and glorious life. And that they can do that. Like, we all have that power. We all have that strength. You might need some help accessing it, but everybody's born with that. Because I'm not special.
Wow. You just knocked it out of the park. I've done a lot of these in my time. Wow. I'm going to air this as our 100th episode.
Oh, honey pie.
Yeah, I am. I think it encapsulates the work.
You made me cry.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
You know, I've probably done a dozen and a half of these podcasts over the years, and you are unique in my experience. Your ability to just really, like, your willingness, it's, yes, it's ability for sure, but your willingness to be just present with what's unfolding and let it unfold in its own pace and in its own way and so authentically is so empowering. As your guest, it's so empowering. And I really appreciate that that's how you come to the table and what that allows me to bring to the table. I'm so grateful to you for that.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. And no one's, certainly people I've talked to have talked about the experience of, you know, working in conversation, but no one has ever explained it that way. So thank you.
You're welcome.
That meant a lot. It's hard to explain these conversations and what they've meant to me. The privilege and honor to sit with someone right there in their suffering, heartbreak, their love, their humor, their wisdom, all of it, all of their humanity. I've been thinking a lot and trying to synthesize the gifts that have come as a result of this show, from spending 5 years with 100 people who trusted me with their stories. And I want to tell you a little secret. We never really knew what we were making exactly, because it wasn't about us. It was about the storytellers. And it was about you guys and helping us all to feel a little less alone in the world. That is all I ever wanted, to connect us, for all of us to feel less alone. So thank you. Yes, you listening to this right now, thank you for being part of the All the Wiser family. And while we may have never met in person, we have been through a lot together these past 5 years. And we now share a bond, a connection that will live on long after the end of the show. I hope you will join us for the grand finale of All the Wiser. We will be here next Wednesday with a very, very special final episode. We're going to hear from our guests, our listeners, and our team about how we have been changed by this show and sharing it with you.
All the Wiser has been produced by Podkit Productions, Erica Gerard, and I, Tara Daigle, have been All the Wiser's associate producer. Our composer, sound designer, and editor was John LaSala. And that just leaves us with my great friend, Kimmy Culp, whose brainchild this whole podcast has been. So until next time, and who knows when or if that next time ever will be, take care of yourself and take care of one another. I'm gonna go cry now. Wait till I tell Kimmy.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video, find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.